I think that people have been so traumatized by formal finance that actually there are people who are unbanked, or they choose to be underbanked, which means basically they'll do the most minimal activities because of the horror stories that they have to endure. Racism, and specifically anti-Black racism in commercial banks, is not a secret anymore, that people would like to avoid those kinds of stressors and engage with people who actually value their humanity.
This is Frontiers of Commoning with David Bollier.
My guest today is Caroline Shahnaz Hussain, professor of global development at the University of Toronto at Scarborough in Ontario, Canada. For years, Professor Hussain has studied the Black social economy in the Americas, and especially cooperatives and informal economy. It's an avenue of research that calls into question the premises of standard economics while documenting social and economic histories that are otherwise forgotten, even in the academic literature. It turns out that Black women in Africa, the Caribbean, and North America have been doing lots of do-it-together finance through self-organized social groups, all of it beneath the radar screens of mainstream banking and state regulation for the most part. Much of Professor Hussain's work is therefore about decolonizing our very conception of the economy by showcasing the solidarity in social economies. Her many books and essays elevate the racialized and feminist dimensions of economic life that are often ignored, and she offers some fresh perspectives on the commons as well. Caroline, welcome to Frontiers of Commoning.
Thank you, David. Glad to be here with you.
Why don't we start with you just explaining what the social economy is, and especially putting it in the context of African, Caribbean, and North American experience.
So the social economy, as it's often defined, and it's a concept that's been used primarily, I'd say, in the UK and Canada, and to some extent in the US among some circles. The older term was the third sector, which is pretty much anything that is not government or that is not private sector, firms, companies, that kind of thing. So the third sector or the social economy, it's actually kind of one of these fuzzy kinds of concepts that have, you know, nonprofits, social enterprises, community economic development associations, you can have mutual aid groups. But there is this mainstream understanding of the social economy as something that interacts with the private sector and the government, collaborates with them. And that's where it gets kind of sticky when you start to throw in this concept of identities. And I'm primarily interested in how resources are shared, how do people participate, what happens to people who are excluded, not just from the state and private sector, but when they go and take refuge in the social economy or the third sector, how are they received? Are they often on the receiving end? Are their own work recognized within the social economy? And often what we find is that groups, particularly those that have been historically marginalized, like people of African origin, so the diaspora, wherever they be, outside of Africa, have often been some of the most excluded groups of people. And I would name that as being Black diaspora women, one of the most excluded, and Indigenous women.
So essentially, mainstream economics hasn't deigned to theorize this area. So it's kind of this catch-all category for all sorts of phenomena that are not market transactions.
Correct. You have this group of that's kind of trying to engage. There's this assumption that people, this catch-all, as you said, will sort of try to participate or interact with the state or with the government. But what happens when there are real tensions or violence occurring against certain groups of people? What does the social economy or third sector do to sort of reach those groups? And that's what I'm interested in. So I'm actually currently at the process where I'm really think we have to stop using that concept, social economy, and move to something called the solidarity economy and catch up with the rest of the world, because that's what everyone on this planet is referring to it as. And then we start to orient actual solidarity economies as something as a site of struggle, right? You're not supposed to try to be obedient and conform or cooperate with states and businesses that have been hostile unfair and discriminatory towards certain segments of the population, right? You can see that troubling the social economy is right now really important, and we have to start, I think I'm pushing for us to move the language towards solidarity economies. And I use this concept of the Black social economy as a way to start getting us there.
Well, you wrote a paper in 2019, A Black Epistemology for the Social and Solidarity Economy, which is a topic dear to my heart in terms of starting to theorize and provide a different language for these alternative ways of being and knowing and acting, which standard economics with Homo economicus and rational utility and so forth just does not speak to.
Correct. You know, there's so much out there. When I started thinking about political economy as a student back, I don't know, in the early 2000s, where you're taught a really conservative version, a very mainstream version of what political economy looks like. But as you start to look more deeply, you start to realize that there are so many scholars in and out of the Western world, a lot of Black scholars, even within the Western world, who are writing really interesting work about cooperatives, collectives, commoning, the sharing economy in ways that we have not seen, and they've been hidden. And this work has been around for decades. And what I'm trying to do through that paper that you read, it's really just evolving. That was my first attempt at trying to create a hub of knowledge to sort of map out the vast understanding of what solidarity economies actually mean for people who have been excluded from the third sector. And so there's really a rich landscape for thinking through that.
Tell me what that economy does mean to people. Also, tell me who are some of the guiding stars in your work from decades past who've illuminated this path.
There's a lot of people who've paved the way, because that's something that's really important. I find that what the Black social economy is doing is building on that work. And so what I'm doing, I don't feel like I'm really innovating in terms of what the Black social economy is, as much as I'm shining a light on work that's already been there and speaking about how do you co-opt economic and social goods in a very politicized manner. So that's really the essence of what these Black social economy hub or theorizing or body of work is trying to do. It's trying to collect all these scholars. And I'm just starting to scratch the surface in terms of all the work that's out there. But really what they're all speaking to is how people in various ways try to, I think, rebel against mainstream economics and even standard political science about how power is distributed in ways to ensure that they're living humanely, below the surface, out of reach of these kind of rogue institutions that really aren't prioritizing well-being for all of us. So some of the people that have done a lot of the work in this area, I'd like to give shout outs to. I'm not going to give them in order, but definitely Marcus Garvey. He was more of an activist than a scholar in so many ways, but he has a lot of writing about what it means to be self-reliant when you're under attack, and has pretty much an amazing action plan when you think about the cooperatives, Black Doll Factories or cooperative laundromats, or had one of the largest member-owned institutions at the time called the UNIA out of Harlem. I mean, really an advocate for thinking through cooperation, participating and paying dues, because I think it's something that he learned in his homeland, and actually being a migrant worker in a number of countries, seeing how this capitalist system actually hurts people and really wants to set up a system of winners and losers. And how do you defeat that system by creating something that's more collective? But people like Du Bois, people don't realize that Du Bois was writing about group economics and traced that throughout sub-Saharan Africa, was a huge advocate for that in the US. That leads to the work of Curtis Haynes at Buffalo State, who I'm really inspired by. I myself have said many times that I'm building off the work of Jessica Gordon Nembhard, who wrote Collective Courage, really unearthing a story that people denied actually happened in American history, that they were cooperators.
This being the history of African-American collective emancipation through co-ops.
Exactly. And it was something that's been denied, a history that's been hidden for so long. There are so many other scholars that are thinking and writing. One that right now I'm doing a paper on is a dependency economist by the name of C.Y. Thomas. And he still hangs out at the International Development Institute in Guyana. He must be well into his 80s now. But for many decades, he's been working on this idea of convergence theory. Basically, that's to produce what you need locally as a way to combat this systems theory, right? Where smaller countries are supposed to be used and rely on imports from the West, right? And he said, well, let's try this convergence theory, where we are going to diverge from how they actually want to use us to really concern ourselves about household consumption and become more self-reliant locally. And that actually, C.Y. Thomas's work, what I'm exploring, has inspired community economic development among Aboriginal people here in Canada. So it's really fascinating that there's been all these scholars that have just been completely ignored in terms of thinking through how you can make economics more of a subject that is concerned about the social provisioning of human beings.
It's fascinating because I think there's so many horizontal connections and similarities that haven't yet developed enough yet. Speaking as a commoner, I totally resonate to the idea of decommodifying yourself in the mainstream economy as a way of ensuring your self-determination and emancipation. And indeed, the value of non-market activity versus the pinnacle of market economics, transactions. Trying to get away from the price system as the definition of value to something more humanistic, even spiritual.
And that's exactly what I'm trying. I hope that that's what I'm getting at. It's, you know, I've uncovered all these women who call themselves the banker ladies. And that's precisely what they're putting on the table, is that we have been doing this for centuries, actually. We inherited these systems of collectivity. You can call it commoning, you can call it mutual aid. But this idea where you're actually prioritizing the social aspect of how we engage with things like finance, money, economic resources.
Let's get into the focus of your more recent study on the so-called banker ladies. You've used the term ROSCA, R-O-S-C-A, for rotating savings and credit associations. But you've also noted that many countries around the world, in Africa, the Caribbean, and the rest, have their own names for it. Tell us about this social paradigm of self-help.
So ROSCA, Rotating Savings and Credit Associations, is the formal academic term. We need a term that kind of unites what this phenomenon is, which is a voluntary system of people who call themselves members who decide how they're going to collectively organize resources and then share it out to a group through a very democratic, consulting, very voice-focused process. And these systems are called by a gamut of names, SUSU in Ghana, in parts of the diaspora like Trinidad and Grenada. Then you have Arisan in Indonesia, CHIT funds in India, PATNA among Jamaicans in the diaspora, as well as in their homeland, EKU by Ethiopians and Eritreans, SANDUK by Sudanese. There's just so many names. You know, I'm hard pressed for all these names, but there's so many of them. And it's really speaking to this idea of the vernacular, right? Like this really localized, informal, secret code word that we have for a kind of commoning of resources and financial goods that we do amongst ourselves as a community. And I'm starting to explore what that means. When you do that in various countries, people are sticking to their own sort of cultural grouping when they do this. But as people travel, these systems become much more open to different types of memberships.
Let's start with a concrete example so people can get an idea of what you're talking about. From my understanding, social groups of 10, 15, perhaps more people get together and pool their funds to help each other finance each other sequentially.
So I'm hoping that many of your listeners will be familiar with credit unions. They might be familiar with cooperative banks, depending on where they live. They may even know about community banks. So basically, it's a group of people. I think the smallest Ross guy I've ever heard about was about 7 or 8 members. But they can go upwards. In Senegal, they can have literally hundreds. Those are some of the largest sort of Rasca groups I know about. But what I do know is that Rascas have a starting point and an ending point. So they can start and have a life starting from 6 months. It depends on the group dynamic. They vote and decide how long this process will be. But let's take a number of, 10 for simplicity. You have a group of members, they decide that they want a 10-month cycle, so that every member will contribute $100 every 2 weeks. So by the end of it, hopefully everyone will have, $1,000 or something like that over the period of that time. The idea is mostly a savings sort of function so that people can save and access a lump sum of money in a certain period very quickly without any cost, really. Some Rasca groups might actually, depending on the size of the group or the culture or the dynamic, might actually have a little fee attached to that, depending on how much administration is involved. But generally, it's members who decide how they're doing it. And most of the Rascas I've surveyed, I've met with hundreds of banker ladies. Most of them are done out of just a labor of love. They're just involved in it because they're members themselves and they want to have an access to a lump sum of cash, which they can't ordinarily get from a formal provider without it being so crazy expensive or just not even having access to that. And it's basically their savings. You participate in it for the whole 10 months until everyone has gotten their lump sum. And then the group folds and they might start up a new group. But I'm giving you a random structure for one possible Rascas. But Rascas have no set structure. What you do know is that they have a starting point and an ending point, that everyone gives a fixed sum of money, that people are to meet regularly. So they define what that means and what that looks like, and that it's not just about financial giving and taking. It's also about the camaraderie. And that's the fascinating part of these systems.
Well, I was going to say the two obvious questions are, why not use the bank and why not do it yourself? And I'm sure there's ready answers. One, you've sort of answered the social camaraderie, but why not use a formal bank for this?
Yeah, so when you're speaking to racialized minorities who have often been excluded from formalized banking, that can become a really terrifying experience. It can be full of stressors just going into a formal commercial bank. And so to avoid some of that headache, why not participate with a group of people you actually know and trust? That's the key word, that you know and trust, that may live down the street from you and don't have these rigid hours from 9 to 5, and that you can have a potluck. Everyone brings their palau or their rotis and you kind of have conversation and then you dole out monies to each other. It's actually a really exciting, it's actually a fun way to do banking. What I found from the banker ladies, it's a human process, right? They've really humanized the way that we encounter and deal with money. Money doesn't define who the banker ladies are. They're defining it.
People who've lived in the mainstream economy might be skeptical and say, but what about the security of this? Mm-hmm. What about if the money gets absconded with or stolen? Some of those people of the mainstream economy said, that's why I'm going to a bank. I'm not going to put it under a mattress that the banker lady holds.
Correct. The one thing that you have to be sure about is that when you're participating in a Rasca, all the risks are known to their members, most definitely. And there are consequences when you don't participate as a member should. And people are also very much aware of what that consequence might look like. And the sanctions locally can be quite intense, actually, more so than any kind of commercial bank. But I think that people have been so traumatized by formal finance that actually there are people who are unbanked, or they choose to be underbanked, which means basically they'll do the most minimal activities because of the horror stories that they have to endure. Racism, and specifically anti-Black racism in commercial banks, is not a secret anymore, that people would like to avoid those kinds of stressors and engage with people who actually value their humanity and that they can access the lump sum of cash that they need to do the work they need. So you have a group of people who know and trust each other. They actually like each other. People vouch for people to be a part of the group. It's not anyone from the street who can join a ROSCA. Like I said, you have to be engaged with your neighbors and your friends. There has to be a friendship there. There has to be some respect for what you're doing. People get vetted like you would in any kind of bank without all of the crazy paperwork. I mean, some ROSCAs are quite sophisticated. They have major Excel sheets going on. Other ones are much more informal. It's verbal and it's in front of audience, right? Like sort of that kind of testimonial. But generally, it's a space for people who are often the most excluded and unreached people, that they can find a space where they can work with people who can sympathize and strive with them to achieve their life goals.
What's so fascinating about this to me is the tension between this informal do-it-yourself self-help and formalized systems of law and banking that essentially have stigmatized it, or perhaps as bad, made it invisible as something that doesn't exist. Yet this has been a form of people helping each other that's existed for generations, that is in contemporary times beneath our noses, but continues to be stigmatized or ignored.
And so that's part of the struggle that I have as a researcher. That's another show, but doing this kind of research actually in the academy is complex and difficult. And part of it has to do with kind of the stranglehold that I guess mainstream economics, mainstream political science has had on the ways we should organize economics or our economies. So what I find in the work that I'm doing right now is that these banker ladies, I study banker ladies in the Caribbean and in Canada, those of African diaspora background. And they can be Caribbean, they can be African, what have you. First, second generation. And what I found, the divergence is recognizing and appreciating the contributions that the women, the Black women in Canada, do towards self-help, mutual aid, these building these ROSCA systems. Whereas in the Caribbean context, the banker ladies don't live with fear of what they do. People actually understand the ROSCA system in the Global South, specifically in a number of Caribbean cultures. It's actually revered. It's not remunerated, but it's actually respected as sort of a self-help, taking charge, doing sort of due diligence within community to really build up economic development when social services programs fail. Whereas in Canada, we're in complete denial of the diaspora doing this because it actually threatens what we want to know about how ordinary people can do finance. And these women are not bankers by any means, but they're able to distribute a lot of money and cobble it together amongst themselves in spaces where people imagine that there's no social capital that can actually be a form of agency. And so if you can stifle lower income communities and say that what they need is aid, then you're able to control them. With banker ladies, they're like, we're not going to be as compliant because we kind of get what you're doing and we're going to be in charge of our resources because we actually have resources once we start to pool. And that's another name they call it, money pool.
So their very existence is a kind of indictment of the existing system, which is why everybody has to systematically ignore it, because it sort of shows up the deficiencies of the mainstream banking system.
And, you know, the mainstream banking system and all these political elites actually demonize these women. That's the big lie behind all of this, is that they will call them sort of these really horrific names, like they are terrorists or they are money launderers or drug muling. These are women who are organizing informal cooperative systems that we are.
You're talking about the Canadian state regulators of the banking system or the police, or whom?
Police, the state, definitely they are having their resources confiscated when there are any kind of raids going on. If a Somali was to say that is for my Hagbad group, of course there's a lack of education, but they immediately equate the work of Black women as something that is criminal, that is illicit, must be involved in drugs or gang activity. Meanwhile, these are hardworking people who drive our buses, work in our grocery stores, are personal support workers that we have called during the pandemic essential workers, right? Because they have been doing all this hard work when many of us have been hiding in our homes trying to keep safe. They have had to get out there. These are the very women who are participating and using Roscas as a lifeline to realize their own set of life goals, right?
Because to have tens of thousands of dollars floating around, that could only be drug money, is the thinking.
Of course, right? And or they can only be using that for some sort of corruption. But Black women, you know, recently I've been finding all these Black women candidates, they have not been successful yet in their campaigns, but some of them come to me quietly and they say, you know, I got my seed money to run my political campaign at the municipal or local level through a Rosca. One lady sent me a WhatsApp like, look, my campaign election sign was funded through a partner fund. And so the women who she's a part of this Rosca, which is a Jamaican partner, real understood that she needed a lump sum of monies as sort of her seed capital to get these election signs done up, right? So I just think that it's phenomenal that they're using Rosca in ways to create political voice, really to bring it, and because they can't access formal finance.
That kind of is mind-blowing that the social development of Roscas has reached a level that it's not just for conviviality and camaraderie and mutual support. It has these potential political dimensions where people are using it to assert themselves as members of the community who ought to be elected.
Yes, and you can see why that can be threatening to people who are vested in keeping economics the way it is, because it's a matter of controlling and outing the injustices that are occurring in our society. So it's better to scandalize these women as being drug mules and terrorists and money launderers than to recognize their grit and innovations that are occurring in the financial domain, right? And how can we now hire them? You know, that's my push, is why aren't we not hiring them for community economic development programs? Why are we bringing in outsiders who are totally detached from the lived experience of what poverty looks like, and bring in these women who've had to be very creative, but very focused on the collective and the cooperative?
What better vehicle for economic development than Roscas, who know the community, are of the community? They could innovate beyond what they already do.
Totally. But see, they're being accused of being fraudulent and illegal because people are ignorant and refusing to understand these systems that have been around, at least in Canada, for at least a century. So I don't really take it easy when people say, well, I didn't know. Well, you should know that commoning is happening. And if you don't know, that's your problem. But we should not be stigmatizing these women. We should be celebrating and remunerating them for the work they're doing.
It'd be worth looking for a moment at a country like Ghana, where they do have a light touch regulation and even a recognition of them. There isn't the racism involved. It seems there's the state is trying to accommodate and give modest levels of trust in the system. Talk a little bit about why that's different and how that state regulation works.
I'm actually working on a paper on community economies, looking at the Ghana Susu with my colleague, Sammy Bonsu, at the University of Ghana. And actually what we did do is carry out a study of Susu collectors in a number of cities like Tema, Accra, Kumasi, and Cape Coast, where we spoke to dozens of banker ladies who are in charge of various groups to talk about the formality. In Ghana, they've been doing this for centuries. This idea of Susu is sort of like everyone knows about it. Everyone has an opinion about it. What the government has been doing for at least the last 30 years has been on this process of bringing in the part of the Susu system into some sort of oversight by the central government. But here's where they've been smart, Ghana, is that they've recognized that the people who participate in Susu don't want some sort of rigid government control of what they're trying to do. No way. Banker ladies wouldn't put up with that. But there are segments of the population who would appreciate some sort of insurance so that if you're worried about your life savings being absconded and what have you, then there is a kind of susu that is a part of the formal financial sector that you can participate in. Just as microfinance is there, why not have a susu system?
And what sort of requirements, performance requirements or indemnities or whatever do the RASCAs have, does the susu have to have to participate in that? What does the state demand?
First of all, they have this national system, which is, I believe it's called the Ghana Susu Collectors Network Association. So they're sort of responsible for all the susu collectors who decide to be an enterprise, like a susu enterprise. So they pay taxes. If you want to be a susu collector, it has to be registered. It has to be approved by the state. There has to be some sort of insurance that meets state requirements, right? There are certain ways of carrying out the business. You have to have a more structured entity. I've seen some of the susu collectors have an attachment to their house, which is just a space for banking. So you have to kind of try to create a space so that people can access you, not just in your living room or under some tree, but there has to be some sort of effort to do that. There has to be regular monitoring of the women that participate in those formal susu systems. And there's also these meetings and paperwork that a more formalized susu system has to be engaged in, okay?
All of this is acceptable to susu members? They don't consider it too burdensome or intrusive?
So here's the thing. A very small minority, as my colleague Sammy Bonsu, Professor Bonsu will tell you, it's a tiny, tiny drop of susus who are actually formally registered because the millions of women who participate in RASCAs are not formalized. And some actually told us they do both. They do the informal. I think that's why, I mean, Ghana's government has taken on a very pragmatic approach because they know that there's no way to formalize all susu systems in Ghana. And they're okay with having informal susu systems as well as formalized susu systems. They'll promote the formalized ones because the idea is that if fraud or theft happens, there's some sort of security for you. Or if you're in, I don't know, in some sort of legal tension with the susu collector, at least there's some sort of recourse. Informally, that doesn't exist.
So the state has the best of motives in this, or does it have some power-driven motive of control?
Well, it's such a small number right now. It seems as though the people are sort of the ones advocating, from what I see and what we're learning, is that it's actually coming from the society. People are actually requiring the state to remember that susus exist. So if you can make set-asides for these commercial banks and microfinance institutions often run and subsidized by foreigners, maybe you should start thinking about how to develop our susu sector. And so there's another side to this too. Like the state also provides training for the susu collectors. They make sure that they do sort of like professional development, certificates and what have you, so they can be better collectors, which the informal sector will not have. So I think that there seems to be a lot of really well-intentioned, smart people engaged in making sure that the susu system doesn't get co-opted, right? But you can see it's been a trial. It's an upward battle to get susus formalized because so many of them are like, I'm not doing that.
Well, it's a fascinating set of examples to me because in other contexts, there's talk about developing new ways, especially for city governments, to deal with people. And there's talk of commons public partnership. How do bureaucracies assist commoners without simply dictating to them and not collaborating with them? How do they respect the informal bottom-up decision-making and responsibility and authority while still having some legitimate state role in that? And I think that that's an open question right now. There's a number of different experiments, but given the distrust of the state these days, I think we need to explore these kind of commons public partnerships as a new way forward.
More recently, I think that people are watching me in a very questionable way because I keep saying that we need the Kundumbashri system in Canada. And people are like, what is Kundumbashree? Well, Kundumbashree is actually an Indian concept coming out of the state of Kerala in South India. So many listeners might be familiar with sort of the magnificent work that has been going on for decades, if not centuries, in South India, particularly with gender equality, but also with cooperation and mutual aid and self-help groups. And the Kundumbashree system started in 1990. A lot of hard work has been done on that by the scholars. One of my good colleagues, Christabel PJ at the University of Kerala, has done a lot of research on the Kundumbashree system. And it's a state project that links up with local village councils called Panchayati Raj, where they have mandated that women and lower caste people be represented in the governance. And of course, at times, you know, they could be fronted by their bosses or men or what have you. But generally, what they're trying to get at is have more gender equity involved in decision making, planning, both in the economy, but also social development. And the Kundumbashree movement has been highly regarded. It's been replicated in a number of countries for countries who have a problem with equity. And I think that in Canada, we have a problem. The US has a problem with equitable outcomes, particularly in economic development. So why not look at the Global South as providing us some technical assistance in the first world? We're so into giving our expertise and going over as the expert. But I do think the Kundumbashree system, mostly led by women, fearless women, who are huge proponents of cooperation and commoning, that they could actually come and give us some lessons on what equity looks like.
Play that scenario out a little bit more in terms of how that system could indeed provide opportunity and equity and lasting development change.
What I've been advocating is that, one, particularly in the Canadian context, perhaps the Caribbean context is a little bit advanced in that they already recognize their banker ladies. But in Canada, we're in denial or we're stigmatizing them. So what we could do is bring in leading experts, trained scholars that have worked for decades on the Kundumbashree and self-help movement in Kerala to come to parts of major cities in Canada that are struggling with ideas of stratification, economics, or inequities that are really built in. And because they're used to all these sort of tribal issues and caste issues, how do we deal with the dimensions of race issues, linguistic issues, I don't know, class-based issues in the Canadian context? And how do we roll out development programming in ways that we actually get voice from people who have only apathy and distrust for the state? How do we start mobilizing them? They're already there, but I think these people who have been doing it for decades, what their expertise is how do you round up the most informal people? And I remember reading in Bina Agarwal's recent article on the Kundumbashree system, people were like, these groups are so informal. How are you ever going to bring them together? Today, that is what their expertise. Their expertise is going where no one's gone before, rounding up these people, seeing them, and trying to figure out how do they help now implement and direct policy. We're missing that in the Canadian environment because we're not listening to these people.
One could even expand upon that and say that formal systems that have become so sterile, involuted, and unimaginative need to open themselves to the innovation that only informality can provide. The way the proprietary software system, which had a stranglehold by Microsoft, needed a kick in the butt by Linux and lots of open source systems, which were basically self-organized collectives of coders. More generally, the idea of informality, which lies at the heart of commons, is perhaps one of the more potent vehicles of innovation. It's just it's not necessarily regimented and corporatized.
Yeah, no, totally. And I do think that it's that idea that we are experts in how to value what is happening in the informal. Because our focus in the West, primarily with marginalized groups, has been to formalize everyone and to demonize the concept of informality. I'd like to think that COVID has really pushed us to a place where now we're understanding the value of mutual aid and actually doing things in the informal, assisting your neighbors get sort of bare essentials informally is actually a good thing. So that not everything in the informal is dark and dirty, that it is a way to thrive for people who have been under persecution.
But there's a cautionary note that I would inject based on the history of microfinance, which you've also studied, and how it was once hailed as a vehicle for emancipation among people in need, but it's been co-opted and controlled by the formal banking system and investors to basically reinforce unequal power dynamics in their own cultures. So how does the informal protect itself against the formal?
That's the threat, right? That's the threat to the commons. That's the threat to collectives, even cooperatives today, right? Who really were born out of crisis. Many of them started in the informal, but so many of our cooperatives have moved really towards the mainstream. But they have this idea of members owned. So I don't give up on cooperative, formal cooperative institutions, because I do see the one member, one vote as being something that's sacred. And I think that if we can start developing structures that are fundamentally collective and cooperative in our mission, that can be an antidote to this sort of individualized form of finance, right? Yes, while microfinance has been troubling in terms of freeing people, there has been aspects of it that have made many people succumb to this idea of the rational economic actor. But there has been microfinance programs that have been very cooperative in nature, that have been more homegrown. I always point to the case in Haiti that really, really had excellent forms of microfinance, because it forced the commercial microfinance sector to adapt to a more cooperative, membered own form of microbanking. One way to push against sort of that vile takeover of corporations is to ensure that we're politicizing the kind of cooperation we're thinking about and being really thoughtful about that. But you're right, that's the risk with a lot of these systems. Once the mainstream figures it out, it's like, how do they become like us, right?
Just to pursue that point one step further, to protect themselves, they'll need the structural systems, like, as you said, members only, or participation, or tell me more about the other means they can fight with socially or legally to protect the integrity of their informal systems.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, I mean, I'm still exploring this, but even India, who has lots of regulation on these chit and sort of collective systems, and Ghana and Susu, they have taken a really pragmatic approach to how we think about recognizing institutions. Is the choice only between being informal and formal? Can we have something called non-formal? Like, are there other ways of recognizing things that are informal and letting them be, because they just need to operate that way until people want to decide that they may want to join a more formalized RASCA? There are lots of people I've had this debate locally and had focus groups on this, and it's a really divided, debatable concept. There are people who feel very strongly against formalization because they're terrorized in their society. The informal is the only way that they believe that they can continue doing what they're doing. And if we were to formalize, then maybe these systems would have to go even further underground. So, and that's worrying, right? But if there is a way that we can appreciate these systems, provide resources so that they can succeed and tap into it if they want, then wonderful. But it will take a change of mindset. So when I hear about these women, these particularly young women, using RASCA systems to advance in political office because they really do believe there has to be a shift in the way we're thinking about economics and politics, that's the way things are going to change, is that when you have people who are, to use your words, thinking like a commoner come into office, then they're going to start thinking about, well, do these structures and the ways that we approach formality actually work for these kinds of groups? And how much reflexivity do we need in order for these kinds of cooperative banks, like, what is it that we need for them to thrive? And is it possible to have multiple types of policy making for these different types of RASCAs?
People need trust, social coherence, elemental structure, but they're not getting that from the formal systems. I'd like you to briefly describe the Diverse Solidarity Economies Collective that you founded, which is essentially trying to recognize and elevate these diverse ways of approaching economic self-sufficiency and empowerment. Tell me about that association and what you're trying to achieve through it.
It's called the Dice Collective. It's fairly new. We started off in around 2016 or 17 as the Black Social Economy Hub, and it's had a few iterations. And together with my colleague at the University of Kerala, Dr. Christabel PJ, in 2018, we really decided to be more publicly known. And so we created this thing called the Dice Lab, and it's called the Dice Collective. And it's basically made up of about 20 to 25 scholars. The list keeps growing. Racialized global majority scholars who are women from various ethnic backgrounds who are full-time researchers either in institutes or universities who are really thinking in a really heterodox way about political economy. And what they're doing is to try to add voice. They're thinking about degrowth. They're thinking about solidarity economies, community economies in ways that have been so sidelined in the academy. And so what we're trying to do is create a support system. Not only are we being rejected as women of color scholars from having our work cited and noted in many of these books, but we're also finding that the kinds of ideas that we're thinking about, we don't have a space in a lot of the academic conferencing. So we're creating our collective so that we can share our ideas with one another. So before we go through the publishing pipeline and creating network. So many of us are publishing together, we are reading each other's work, we are engaging in field work together, sharing stories. It's really a support system, policy making. When government is requesting something, instead of myself just going, I'll invite other members of the DICE collective to join me, because I think that we have multiple ways of seeing underdevelopment and we're working together to get this work done.
Fascinating. Well, I'm thrilled to hear of that, because we need those kinds of alternative economic perspectives to grow more. And to, as we talked about earlier, to have develop more horizontal connections with the kin enterprises like degrowth and solidarity economy. Tell me where you see your research going from here.
Right now, I'm trying to work on the international cooperative sector. I want to push formal cooperatives to start recognizing the ROSCA system, not just at a national level, but at a global level. So I'm really pushing for the International Cooperative Alliance to make space for African diaspora. I want our stories about cooperation in whatever informal capacity they exist in to be noted. Another thing that's important for me is to really start moving to this concept of solidarity economies, move away from social economy that presumes that we have to interact with the state and private sector. If that's not working, there is reason for it, and we need to start thinking about how do we resist systems that are oppressive in the economy. And really that starts with how we define and think about language and the theories we use. So my work is moving more in the cooperative space and thinking in a more global way about what cooperatives look like, because I think they can be used as a vehicle for many of us who are focused on member-owned types of institutions, whatever they look like. So I'm really playing with this idea of cooperativism as something that is very multiple-tiered, so including self-help groups and including mutual aid, ROSCAs, commoning, random community associations, because I do think we've been fixated for too long on cooperatives as very formal institutions controlled by white privileged men. And if we want to expand that tent of what an economic model should look like, so we're not constantly being told this is the model we have to follow, then we need to start opening up to make the cooperative system much more inclusive of other groups who actually understand it. But that will mean educating people about why informality matters when we speak about the commons. Why is that useful and not something to be demonized? So I'm really sort of working through cooperativism and solidarity systems at a global level.
Carolyn Hussein, I want to thank you so much for sharing your work and perspectives with us, and we look forward to more of your work in the future.
Thank you, David. It was a pleasure being with you.